Lecture 8, Integrating Dialogue into a Narrative.
In my first lecture about dialogue, I said that speech in fiction has to serve a purpose, no matter how rambling, digressive, elaborate, or colorful it is. I also said that, generally speaking, dialogue is used to evoke character, advance the story, and provide exposition. In this lecture, I want to talk in more detail about how you can use dialogue to serve those purposes, and I also want to talk about how you can find the balance between dialogue and the other parts of the narrative. Some stories and novels are made up almost entirely of dialogue, while some stories use it only as a seasoning, so to speak. Deciding just how much, how often, and how effectively your characters speak will also help you decide just what sort of story you're writing. Let's start with using dialogue to evoke character. As I said in my earlier lectures, character is usually evoked through a variety of techniques, all at once or in close succession. These include description, action, dialogue, interior monologue, and so on. While dialogue doesn't always bear the brunt of characterization, it's certainly not unusual for individual characters to talk in a distinctive way. Charles Dickens is especially known for his colorful secondary characters, who often use catchphrases or speak in a particular dialect. In David Copperfield, for example, there are a number of characters who are memorable for using repeated phrases or words. The oily Uriah Heep, who is one of the villains of the book, frequently mentions how humble he is. The perpetually debt-ridden Mr. Micawber is always counting on the fact that something will turn up. His loyal wife, Mrs. Micawber, who is forced to make do because of his financial ineptitude, constantly swears that she will never desert Micawber. George R. R. Martin, who has proven to be a sort of latter-day Dickens in the scope, variety, and detail of his many colorful characters, also uses this technique with the characters in his fantasy series, A Song of Ice and Fire. The noble Eddard Stark is always repeating the motto of his house, Winter is coming. And the wilding warrior Ygritte is always telling her lover, You know nothing, Jon Snow. And the members of the villainous Lannister family love to repeat their ominous slogan, A Lannister always pays his debts. It's more common, however, for a character to have a distinctive pattern of speech which makes him or her instantly recognizable, rather than an oft-repeated catchphrase. The aforementioned Mr. Micawber, for example, is especially distinguished by his comically elaborate way of expressing himself. It's probably the most memorable thing about him. Here he is, saying goodbye to his friends David Copperfield and Tommy Traddles, as he prepares to move his family to a new job in another city. My dear Copperfield, said Mr. Micawber, rising with one of his thumbs in each of his waistcoat pockets, the companion of my youth, if I may be allowed the expression, and my esteemed friend Traddles, if I may be permitted to call him so, will allow me, on the part of Mrs. Micawber, myself, and our offspring, to thank them in the warmest and most uncompromising terms for their good wishes. It may be expected that on the eve of a migration, which will consign us to a perfectly new existence, Mr. Micawber spoke as if they were going 500,000 miles, I should offer a few valedictory remarks to two such friends as I see before me. Now this goes on for another 4 paragraphs, and it's a lot of fun to read, but by modern standards, it does rather hit the same nail over and over again. A somewhat more modern example is the erudite and rather jolly criminal Caspar Gutman from the Maltese Falcon. Gutman has something of Micawber's pomposity, but he is a much cleverer and more menacing man. Here he is, taking his leave of Sam Spade at the end of the book. Now, sir, we will say goodbye to you unless, the fat puffs around his eyes crinkled, you care to undertake the Constantinople expedition with us? You don't? Well, sir, frankly, I'd like to have you along. You're a man to my liking, a man of many resources and nice judgment. Because we know you're a man of nice judgment, we know we can say goodbye with every assurance that you'll hold the details of our little enterprise in confidence. We know we can count on you to appreciate the fact that, as the situation now stands, any legal difficulties that come to us in connection with these last few days would likewise and equally come to you and the charming Miss O'Shaughnessy. You're too shrewd not to recognize that, sir, I'm sure. Now, this sort of speech works well in stories where the characters are a bit more extreme than they might be in a more realistic narrative. Micawber is a comic character in a Dickens melodrama, while Casper Gutman is a charismatic villain in a noir thriller. When creating more complex characters in less outrageous circumstances, you probably want to tone it down a bit. I want to say a few words here about using dialect in fiction. In the 19th century, lots of writers used it, with the result that a lot of 19th century fiction is now unreadable. In Dracula, for example, there's a long passage in which Bram Stoker tries to reproduce the accent of an old sailor from Yorkshire, and it's almost incomprehensible. Most readers just skip it. More controversially, dialect can come across as offensive or stereotypical. In Huckleberry Finn, Mark Twain reproduced the African-American dialect of the runaway slave, Jim. 50 years later, Zora Neale Hurston had her African-American characters speak in dialect in her novel, Their Eyes Were Watching God. Both Twain and Hurston were recreating patterns of speech they knew from personal experience. In Hurston's case, she was African-American herself, as well as an anthropologist and a folklorist who had done extensive field work across the American South and the Caribbean. But even these two great American writers have been criticized for perpetuating what some critics consider to be a racist stereotype. The problem with dialect is twofold. With its dropped G's, bristling apostrophes, and phonetic spellings, it's often hard to follow. The other problem is that unless the entire work is written in dialect, as Huckleberry Finn is, for example, using dialect while the rest of the narrative is in standard English can have the effect of setting its speakers apart as other and not normal. As a result, it's difficult for the reader to think of them as fully human. Today, most writers evoke dialect in a more subtle fashion. They rely on word choice and variations in grammar and syntax to suggest regional speech or social class, instead of trying to reproduce it in every detail. Consider Beloved, the great novel by Toni Morrison about an African-American family coping with the aftermath of slavery in the years after the Civil War. The characters speak a straightforward, conversational, modern English. Now and then, they use just a bit of slang or non-standard syntax or grammar to suggest their race, social class, and the era. Here's a scene in which the main character, Setha, a pregnant slave who is making a run for her freedom, has gone into labor in a field of wild onions. She has just been discovered by a poor young white girl named Amy. Picking her way through the brush, Amy hollered back to Setha, "What you gonna do, just lay there and foal?" "I can't get up from here," said Setha. "What?" She stopped and turned to hear. "I said I can't get up." Amy drew her arm across her nose and came slowly back to where Setha lay. "It's a house back yonder," she said. "A house?" I passed it. Ain't no regular house with people in it, though. A lean-to, kinda." "How far?" "Make a difference, does it? You stay the night here, snake get you." "Well, you may as well come on. I can't stand up, let alone walk, and God help me, miss, I can't crawl." "Sure you can. Come on," said Amy. This is as close to dialect as Morrison gets in the book. She has Amy use a few slang expressions like gonna and kinda, and some non-standard usage like ain't, and some non-standard constructions like saying it's a house back yonder instead of there's a house back there. It suggests a time and place without the kind of slavish and often off-putting verisimilitude that Twain and Hurston deployed. What it loses in exactitude, it gains in immediacy and intimacy by giving us characters that any reader of any background can identify with. Another author who makes subtle and effective use of dialect is the Scottish mystery writer Denise Mina, whose novels are often set in working-class Glasgow. Instead of troweling on the Scottish dialect, she drops in the occasional turn of phrase or regional slang, using "I" for "yes," for example, or "bairn" for "child." In this way, she conveys a sense of place and of the economic status of each character without making them sound like Groundskeeper Willie from The Simpsons. As I said in my lectures about character, people in fiction generally have something at stake or something that they want. The best way to use dialogue to evoke character is to have them express what they want, though not necessarily directly. In other words, creating effective dialogue for a character involves inhabiting that character's point of view and not necessarily reproducing an accent or a particular pattern of speech. Reviews of fiction often talk about what a great ear a writer has. But creating a character's speech is less about reproducing a dialect or speech mannerism and more about thinking hard about who that character is, where she comes from, and how her speech might reflect her situation at a given moment. A terse character is going to talk in short bursts. An angry character is going to bluster or speak through clenched teeth. A nervous character is going to stammer or ramble on and on. A domineering character might not say much of anything at all, but keep her thoughts to herself, forcing everyone around her to fill in the silence. Or she might rage, overwhelming the people around her. Sometimes characters don't talk about what they want or about the situation they're in. Instead, they might talk about something tangential or even completely unrelated, and their style of speech serves to evoke both the speaker and the milieu. One of the masters of evoking character almost entirely through speech was the crime novelist and former Boston prosecutor George V. Higgins. Here's part of a monologue from the first chapter of his novel, The Friends of Eddie Coyle. In this excerpt, the title character, a small-time Boston criminal, is talking about the time two thugs broke his hand. "What made it hurt more," the stocky man said. "What made it hurt worse was knowing what they were going to do to you, you know? There you are, and they tell you very matter of fact that you made somebody mad. You made a big mistake, and now there's somebody doing time for it. And it isn't anything personal, you understand. It just has to be done. Now get your hand out there. You think about not doing it, you know? I was in Sunday school when I was a kid, and this nun says to me, 'Stick out your hand.' And the first few times I do it, she whacks me right across the knuckles with a steel-edged ruler. It was just like that. So one day I says, when she tells me, 'Put out your hand,' I say, 'No.' And she whaps me right across the face with that ruler. Same thing. Except these guys weren't mad. They aren't mad at you, you know? Guys you see all the time, maybe guys you didn't like, maybe guys you did, had some drinks with, maybe looked out for the girls. Hey, look, Paulie, nothing personal, you know? You made a mistake. The hand. I don't want to have to shoot you, you know? So you stick out the hand, and you get to put out the hand you want. I take the left because I'm right-handed, and I know what's going to happen, like I say. And they put your fingers in a drawer, and then one of them kicks it shut. You ever hear bones breaking? Just like a man snapping a shingle. Hurts like a bastard." In its own way, this is as beautiful as a Puccini aria. It's got rhythm, it's got music, and it tells a little self-contained story. Best of all, it gives you Eddie Coyle, his history, his world, in his own voice, in less than 300 words. It also intrigues the reader and prepares the way for the story to come, and that's a good segue to my next topic, using dialogue to tell the story. The Friends of Eddie Coyle tells a story about an armed robbery and its aftermath, mainly through a series of monologues and conversations. Some of these almost read like a play by Samuel Beckett, if Beckett had been an assistant U.S. attorney. The use of dialogue in crime narratives and detective stories is especially interesting because a mystery often consists of two stories told in tandem with each other. One is the story of the investigation, which is usually chronological, and the other is the story of the events that led up to the crime. The second story is revealed to the reader in bits and pieces, not necessarily in chronological order. This backstory is often told entirely in dialogue, as the detective questions suspects or listens to long statements from witnesses. For example, large sections of the Sherlock Holmes stories are told through dialogue. Characters tell Holmes what they saw, heard, or did, and at the end, Holmes himself gives a long speech that reveals to Watson what actually happened. Another example is our old friend the Maltese Falcon. This novel is almost entirely made up of scenes in which the characters argue, plead, negotiate, and bully each other in offices, apartments, and hotel rooms around San Francisco. There are a few scenes of violent action, but most of the violence, in particular two shootings and a fire on a freighter, takes place off stage, so to speak. The most important elements of the plot involve what the characters say to each other as they fight for advantage, betray each other, and reveal their true natures, all in dialogue. But it isn't just crime fiction that uses dialogue to move the plot along. Another talky novel is Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice. Many of the most important encounters and incidents take place in conversation. During a scene at a ball in Chapter 18, The novel's proud heroine, Elizabeth Bennet, finds herself dancing against her will with the novel's haughty leading man, Mr. Darcy. And the two verbally spar with each other for 3 pages. It's too long to quote here, but it's one of the great romantic duels in literature. And it's one of the models for every scene since in which two lovers spend the first meeting loathing each other. Another one of the novel's most famous scenes is another verbal jousting match near the end of the book. This one is between Elizabeth and the imperious Lady Catherine de Bourgh, who tries to bully Elizabeth into giving up any hopes of marrying her nephew, Mr. Darcy. Again, it's too long to quote, but you can find it in Chapter 56 of Pride and Prejudice. It's one of the great smackdowns in literature, and it's conducted almost entirely in dialogue. But this is not to say that every conversation in fiction is a kind of competition or argument. As I said at the start, people in fiction speak to each other for all the reasons people in real life do. And people in fiction are just as capable of misdirection, confusion, and reticence as real people are. Some of the greatest scenes in literature feature characters who are not actually talking about what's at stake in the scene, but about something else entirely. Characters talk past each other, they lie, they manipulate, they are inarticulate. Sometimes they don't even realize what they're saying or not saying. Dialogue can hide a character's intent as well as show it. Often the meaning of a dialogue is more evident in what the characters don't say than in what they do. A wonderful example is from Part 6 of Tolstoy's Anna Karenina at the start of Chapter 5. In this scene, two minor characters, a middle-aged man named Sergei Ivanovich and a middle-aged woman named Varenka, are picking mushrooms in the forest. Each is in love with the other, and they both sort of know it. Not only is Sergei working up his nerve to ask for Varenka's hand in marriage, but Varenka is expecting him to propose at any moment. Here's the crucial moment where Tolstoy, in the godlike way of the great 19th century novelists, puts us inside both characters' heads simultaneously. And now it was to be decided. She was frightened. Frightened that he would speak and that he would not. He had to declare himself now or never. Sergei Ivanovich felt it too. Everything in Varenka's gaze, color, lowered eyes showed painful expectation. Sergei Ivanovich saw it and pitied her. He even felt that to say nothing now would be to insult her. In his mind, he quickly repeated all the arguments in favor of his decision. He also repeated to himself the words in which he wished to express his proposal. But instead of those words, by some unexpected consideration that occurred to him, he suddenly asked, "And what is the difference between a white boletus and a birch boletus?" Varenka's lips trembled as she answered, "There's hardly any difference in the caps, but in the feet." And as soon as these words were spoken, both he and she understood that the matter was ended, that what was to have been said would not be said, and their excitement, which had reached its highest point just before then, began to subside. In the birch boletus, the foot resembles a 2-day growth of beard on a dark-haired man, Sergei Ivanovich said calmly now. "Yes, that's true," Varenka replied, smiling, and the direction of their walk changed inadvertently. This is one of the most heartbreaking passages I have ever read. Two people coming this close to happiness and mutually losing their nerve. It's the kind of utterly human misunderstanding that has been played for laughs in countless romantic comedies, but Tolstoy allows the inherent tragedy at the heart of this exchange to come to full flower. The most heartbreaking feature of it is the fact that the dialogue in the scene has nothing to do with what's really on the characters' minds. They're thinking about love, but they're talking about mushrooms. And yet, even though the dialogue itself does not actually address the matter at hand or directly express any of the repressed emotion, this seemingly pointless dialogue is crucial to the devastating effect of the scene. In fact, the scene would not work without it. The intensity of their private emotions is juxtaposed on the page with their banal statements about mushrooms. Sergei Ivanovich agonizes for 88 words, pitying Varenka, worrying that he might insult her. In his head, at lightning speed, he reviews one more time all the reasons he should propose to her. Then, when the moment comes, he asks her a useless question about 2 different types of boletus mushroom. Varenka's lips tremble before she gives him an equally banal answer. They both know what's going on, but neither of them will say it aloud. The banality of their speech is the necessary counterpoint to the depth of their feelings. This counterpoint shows us that the one thing Varenka really wants to hear is the one thing Sergei Ivanovich can't bring himself to say. This oblique use of dialogue has become even more subtle in contemporary short fiction. Under the influence of the great short fiction writers of the late 19th and early 20th centuries, such as Anton Chekhov, James Joyce, and Catherine Mansfield, many contemporary short story writers often create powerful scenes in which the dialogue acts in counterpoint to what is actually going on. An expert practitioner of this technique is the great Nobel Prize-winning Canadian writer Alice Munro. In Walker Brothers Cowboy, the very first story of her first collection, Dance of the Happy Shades, she was already a master of the technique. The story is about a married salesman named Ben, who takes his two children with him one day into rural Ontario, where he stops at the house of a woman named Nora, whom he hasn't seen in years. The story is narrated in the present tense by Ben's daughter, but the voice is that of an adult looking back on a situation that she didn't understand at the time. The story is set in the 1930s, and near the end of it, Nora plays a phonograph record and makes the narrator, Ben's daughter, dance with her. As you listen to this excerpt, note how few dialogue tags Munro uses. "She whirls me around in front of my father, causing me to stumble, for I am by no means so swift a pupil as she pretends, and lets me go, breathless. Dance with me, Ben. I'm the world's worst dancer, Nora, and you know it. I certainly never thought so. You would now." She stands in front of him, arms hanging loose and hopeful, her breasts, which a moment ago embarrassed me with their warmth and bulk, rising and falling under her loose flowered dress, her face shining with the exercise and delight. "Ben." My father drops his head and says quietly, "Not me, Nora." This is almost as heartbreaking as the scene from Anna Karenina, but it has a more subtle effect than that scene did for a number of reasons. One reason is that Munro only tells us what her narrator is thinking, unlike Tolstoy, who tells us exactly what both Sergei Ivanovich and Varenka are thinking. We have no direct access to the thoughts of Ben and Nora. We have to infer their emotions from what they say and do, and we can only guess, along with the narrator, what happened between them years ago. Munro's narrator never comes right out and says, "This woman was an old flame of my father's, and now she wants him back." Instead, she allows us to experience the situation as the narrator did, picking up the cues from what she hears and observes, from the way Nora begs him to dance with her, and the way he refuses, from the way her arms hang loose and hopeful and her face shines with delight, and from the way he drops his head and says, "Not me, Nora." Now, in The Maltese Falcon and Pride and Prejudice, the dialogue is more direct and instrumental, with the characters speaking directly to the matter at hand. And in Anna Karenina, Tolstoy makes the subtext explicit by telling us what the characters are thinking. But Alice Munro's dialogue is oblique. It carries a lot of emotion, but it stops just short of addressing the root cause of the emotion. Finally, the most mechanical use of dialogue is to provide exposition. This is the use of dialogue to have one character explain the backstory or impart some necessary information, ostensibly to another character, but in reality, to the reader. When it's done stylishly and evokes character at the same time, it can be a lot of fun. One expert practitioner of expository dialogue was the great American crime novelist Elmore Leonard. Sometimes Leonard also wrote westerns and historical fiction, and his novel Cuba Libre is about an American who gets caught up in the Spanish-American War in 1898. The first chapter of the novel provides an excellent example of using dialogue for exposition. In this chapter, two of the novel's major characters, a couple of cowboys who are planning to ship some horses to Cuba, sit with their feet up on the railing of a hotel in Texas and talk about their deal. During this conversation, they fill in their own backstories and, at the same time, provide the reader with a quick and dirty history of the war in Cuba. It goes on for several pages, but here's just a taste of it. Tyler said, "What about the war going on down there? It was in the paper the whole time I was at Yuma, the Cubans fighting for their independence. They were getting to it now." "It isn't like a real war," Charlie Burke said. "The two sides line up and shoot at each other. It's more like a hit and run. The Cuban insurgents blow up railroad tracks, raid the big estates, burn down sugar mills, and the Spanish army, the Dons, chase after them. You understand that's what gives us our market, replacing the stock they run off or kill. Once I'd made a few trips for a Texas outfit, ships cattle down there, it dawned on me, hell, I can run this kind of business. No time at all, I'm living in railroad hotels and drinking red wine with my supper. This is very economically and charmingly done. It tells us what we need to know about the politics of the situation they're getting themselves into, or at least enough to start with. At the same time, it still sounds like a couple of guys sitting around and talking. But even in this expertly written passage, we never quite lose sight of the fact that Elmore Leonard is sneaking a little history past us. It's painlessly done, and he introduces us to two important characters at the same time, but it's not as seamless or engrossing as the rest of the book. Even for a great writer like Elmore Leonard, working in the exposition can be tricky. We've all read books in which an especially flat minor character is wheeled on to explain the backstory and then wheeled off, never to be heard from again. Take the second chapter of Conan Doyle's The Hound of the Baskervilles, for example. A character named Dr. Mortimer introduces the necessary background of the case by reading aloud from a couple of documents and then telling Holmes and Watson what he himself witnessed. Mortimer is thinly characterized as a practical-minded country doctor, but his main function in the story is to turn up from time to time and explain things. After delivering that backstory in the introductory chapter, Mortimer could disappear, and the book would be essentially the same without him. So instead of trying to shoehorn exposition into dialogue, I would suggest three alternate methods. The simplest way is just to flat out violate the old show-don't-tell rule and provide the information directly to the reader in the narration itself. This is what I usually do. In two of my novels, The Lecturer's Tale and Kings of Infinite Space, I have a dramatic opening chapter or two to draw the reader into the story. Then I put the main narrative on hold while I fill in the background of the main character for a whole chapter. If your story is told in the first person, and that narrator is privy to the information you need to get across, you could have him or her do the same thing. Or, if the information absolutely has to come from a particular character at a particular moment in the story, you should consider using what's known as indirect dialogue, which is a summary of what a character has said without using his or her exact words. For example, you could distill Eddie Coyle's speech about getting his fingers broken into indirect dialogue, like this. Eddie explained that getting your fingers broken was like having the nuns slap your hand with a ruler back in Sunday school. They'd tell you to hold out your hand, and knowing what was going to happen only made the pain worse. The difference, Eddie said, was that the guys who broke your fingers weren't mad at you. They made you choose a hand and put your fingers in a drawer, then they'd kick the drawer shut. Eddie said it hurt like a bastard. Now, this doesn't have the poetry of the original, but it gets across the same information more quickly. In the next lecture, I'll be starting a block of 6 lectures about plot. In the introductory lecture, I'll be comparing 3 different types of plot, using as examples Joseph Conrad's novel Lord Jim, George R.R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire, and the Bruce Willis movie Die Hard. Meanwhile, here's another dialogue exercise. Without invading anybody's privacy, take a fragment of real-life conversation, one you may have been party to, or a brief exchange between 2 people you may have overheard in a public place, and try to construct a more lengthy and detailed dialogue out of it. It could be something as banal as one person asking, "Is this seat taken?" and the other replying, "No, it isn't." Or it could be freighted with significance, such as one person saying to another, "So what did you tell him?" and the other person saying, "I told him no." Whatever fragment you use, start by figuring out what the next line would be and try to spin as much out of it as you can, incorporating as many of the uses to which dialogue can be put as you can. In other words, starting with just 2 overheard lines, use dialogue to create a couple of characters and tell a little story. It may sound daunting, and it may be a bit tough to get started, depending on what 2 sentences you start with. But once you get going, I think you can have fun with it. The point of the exercise is to reinforce what I've been saying in these 2 lectures, namely that dialogue is not a separate beast from the rest of fiction writing, but an integral part of storytelling that can bear the weight of almost everything fiction can do.